Hello, I'm Jim Ausman, and I'd like to introduce you to the next lecture, which is a lecture on major advances in the CNS. This talk is going to be about software in the brain. It'll be given by Itzhak Fried, who is a professor of neurosurgery and psychiatry at UCLA, and has worked in this area for many years. With him on the panel is Antonio De Salles, who's founder and chief of NeuroSapiens in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Atherinum, professor and head of neurosurgery at Aga Khan University, and Jorge Lazareff, also from UCLA, formerly head of pediatrics. I'd like to give you some background to Itzhak's lecture. It's an excellent lecture covering a lot of ground. But we have to go back 120 years. By that time in the 1900s, neurons, the structure of neurons were known. The physiology was being studied and elucidated, and so everyone knew how electrical impulses were generated and would generate a signal. So we knew the physiology of the nerves. Ramon y Cajal was able, through excellent histology and histopathology, show us the neural networks in the brain. Imaging at the time wasn't really very good. In the 20s, there was ventriculography. In the 30s, Egas Moniz developed angiography. And also in the late 30s and 40s, there was a neurosurgeon in Canada by the name of Wilder Penfield. Wilder Penfield was the first person really to open the skull in patients who are awake and then stimulate the cortex. Revolutionary studies showing where the motor strip was, sensory strip, hearing could be located, stimulation could produce visual experiences, and he was able to elicit memories. He could show memories in patients. In the this work continued with more evaluation of people with epilepsy, identifying the foci and being able to surgically treat them. But also in the 50s and 60s, movement disorders began to be treated with surgery, stereotactic neurosurgery, where lesions in the basal ganglia would be made in order to diminish the tremors from Parkinson's disease with some success. In the early 60s, biochemical treatments were developed using L-DOPA to treat Parkinson's disease in the brain with a high degree of success. This was revolutionary in its own way, because what it showed is that neural problems in the brain could be treated chemically and with excellent results. So not only did we have surgical treatments, we had chemical treatments for a while. The chemical treatments overshadowed the surgical treatments. EEG and complex monitoring was developed in the 70s and 80s and the 90s. That was the time when we first began to have CTs and MRs. And the technological revolution came. And with that, we had more complex analysis of EEGs and signals from the brain, which enabled more refined epilepsy surgery. We could see the structure of the brain on MR and CT in more detail, which led to more detailed placing of electrodes in the brain for recording, which would also be from not only multiple cells, but single cells, and also stimulation, which could be used in various portions of the basal ganglia to treat Parkinson's disease. So now we're in the early 2000s, 2010, and people began to wonder what could be done to treat patients who had depression, major depression, that failed any kind of known treatment. And so it was thought that making lesions in the brain using a DBS, a deep brain stimulation, could be used. And the first patients were treated in Toronto, Ontario, with good results to treat people with basically untreatable depression. Now, these people could be helped with certain forms of functional neurosurgery. Sooner than more diseases were added, like obsessive compulsive disease. And as Tony DeSalis gave in his lecture on the past, present, and future of functional neurosurgery, obesity, addiction, and others are now on the list of things that can be treated. Itzhak has been working in epilepsy for some years and worked on a new technique that was developed that was also revolutionary. Recordings could be made from a seizure focus in the brain, transmitted to a modulator stimulator sensor under the skin, which had a computer program in it, would analyze the signals, see if an epileptic seizure was coming, and then send a stimulus to the brain to stop the seizure. It was a closed loop system. It was a revolutionary idea because it meant maybe that could be used for other disorders of the brain. And so Itzhak has continued his work. That, by the way, was called responsive neurostimulation. Responsive neurostimulation, RNS. You'll see that in abbreviation in Itzhak's talk. That's what it means, responsive neurostimulation. So Itzhak began to work further in memory. It began to be localized to the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex. He did some work he'll share with you that showed that if you stimulate the entorhinal cortex in animals, you're able to improve their memories of things that they had seen before, and they would go localize those things immediately because it was obviously prominent in their memory. The potential for this to be used in human disease is very attractive, and Itzhak will tell you more about his groundbreaking work in these areas. Obviously, one of the areas is Alzheimer's disease. Over 100 million cases of Alzheimer's disease will be present in the world by 2050. And these are people who suffer from early memory disorders. I can't remember what they had for breakfast. But by stimulation of the entorhinal cortex, they can remember that earlier, which would help a large category of patients with a very disabling feature of their disease. Itzhak believes this could be done by something similar to a hearing aid for hearing loss, which can either go to the directly to the ear canal or can be directly transmitted to the brain. And so this could be done in memory disorders and other disorders that are waiting to be discovered. So this is the future you're going to see in your lifetime by 2050. Now we're at a very primitive stage of 2021. In the next 30 years, the research is going to advance in these areas. And these are things that our neurosurgeons are going to be involved in. Neurosurgeons, in preference to anyone else, because they can operate on the brain, they can stimulate the brain, they can enter the brain. This is one of the future areas of growth of neurosurgery. Tony has mentioned this in his talk. Functional neurosurgery is a huge area of neurosurgery expansion. After Itzhak gives his lecture, I'll give a summary of what I thought about the meeting and the various talks were given and what that really means to us. So we hope you'll enjoy all this. We appreciate your being here. And Itzhak, please proceed.
Well, welcome everybody. It's a real pleasure to be in this session, in this great educational experience. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to people in so many geographical regions. So we're going to take a little leap perhaps into the future, part of which is actually present, and we'll talk about maybe changes in our profession. And essentially I'd like to look at it as hardware and software. And I think, you know, we are obviously very accustomed to dealing with the hardware of the brain. And I think in the future, the future neurosurgeons are will have to become expert in the software and the language of the nervous system. So with application to memory in particular, I guess I'd like to look at it as a challenges of perhaps enhancement first as a general goal of enhancement of a neurological function. But perhaps further in the future, inception and deletions of particular memories, particular thoughts, and all this, you know, at the service of neurological problems that are going to become more and more severe in the future. So if we are actually looking at what is awaiting us, we only have to look at the present or even in the last 10 years and see the prevalence of neurological disorder by cause. And of course, we know about epilepsy, we know about Parkinson's disease, but right there are also Alzheimer's disease and the other dementias. And of course, the neuropsychiatric disorders that that we can see, all those affective disorder, anxiety disorder, depression, alcohol and addiction, drugs and drug abuse, bipolar disorders, eating disorders, and such disorders that are already a topic of neurosurgical interest. So in a way, I think that we are facing a cognitive tsunami, meaning that if you just look at the picture of Alzheimer's disease, you realize that by the mid section of this century, we're going to have over 100 million of people affected with it. Probably every one of us or every one of our children will recognize somebody in their vicinity who is affected with Alzheimer's disease. And right now, of course, there is no pharmacological options. And I think we have, looking at the brain as an electrochemical machine, we have to consider what can be done by neurosurgeons in this setting. So I think over the last decade, there is really sort of opening up of brain surgery. You know, in this article in Nature, you know, over 10 years ago, they're already seeing the trend of opening up our field and being really critical in the transition of basic neuroscience into what we call translational neuroscience. Here we see, you know, DARPA wants to fix broken brains. And indeed, DARPA and obviously NIH and the NSF and the European agencies and agencies all over the world are now turning increasing attention to this issue of translation of brain scientists, sciences into practical application. Now, I think we can look at it as a challenge really of fixing brain circuits. And it's now fashionable to talk about brain circuits. And we as a neurosurgeon have to really think about it. We're already doing it, obviously. We're doing it in Parkinson's disease, in movement disorder. We're doing it in epilepsy. But we are slowly venturing into neuropsychiatry, as you know well, mainly with depression, pain, PTSD, OCD, addiction. And right, you know, behind the corner is one of the most difficult challenges of really interfering in the cognitive domain in general and in memory in particular. So let me take on this challenge, just talk a little bit about it. I think the challenges that we faced have really several aspects. One is a science challenge. You know, we need to understand the neural code for what we do. You know, as neurosurgeon, we had to deal with situation where obviously neither we nor other people knew exactly what we were doing. You know, we are treating effectively Parkinson and dystonia, and the understanding of those circuits has only gradually emerged And certainly treatment was available before we completely understand it. So we are kind of in a gray zone of, on the one hand, you know, we want to understand what we are doing. On the other hand, our patients, you know, need to have some solution to a pressing issue. So the other challenge is the engineering challenge, as you know, and then there is obviously the medical challenge, you know, who should get the treatment and under what clinical circumstances. And there obviously is a societal issue of what we can do from an ethical standpoint. Are the remedies that we envision for neurological patients, are they going to be embraced, you know, by the general public? And then who is going to set the rules and the criteria for this situation? So this is what we are facing. Now, we go back, you know, and we owe a lot, really, to Penfield, who was already, I think, thinking in these functional terms already in the mid section of the 20th century. You can see him, obviously, in the classical situation of local anesthesia. You see the components of the team, right? You see the patient, obviously, under local anesthesia with the red arrow at the bottom. You see Penfield and his assistant operating. You see Jasper in the gallery there, you know, looking at the electrophysiology. And that was really the beginning, I think, of an era. And And of course, we all know that even this situation really yielded a lot in terms of understanding the homunculus, all the language areas, just by using this method, which we are still using today. And Penfield, you know, as he was really looking and applying stimulation to the brain, patient really expressed all these experiences. Suddenly, flashbacks came back, memories came back, but it was just, you know, incidental, and it was just a milliamperes of current were channeled into the brain, and suddenly a memory appeared. You know, it was very special, and obviously you can imagine the excitement at that time of getting such a complex function out of just applying electrical stimulation to the brain. That's why Penfield already said at that time that there is a permanent record of the stream of consciousness within the brain. And hidden in the interpretive areas of the temporal lobe, there is a mechanism that unlocks the past. This is 1958. Of course, Penfield was a great pioneer and, you know, had a really philosophical and also practical approaches combined. And, you know, I like the statement, yes, the brain is the organ of destiny. It holds within it humming mechanism secrets that will determine the future of the human race. And this is indeed true. Even at that time, you know, he was able to really envision that. And we're using the same type of situation today. You know, patients are being operated under local anesthesia. Here is a girl, 14-year-old, under local anesthesia, talking a storm during operation on the language area, top, bottom. Here you can see a violinist, which I operated on for essential tremor. I wanted to really find the ultimate point which you could play the violin with no tremor, which we did. So these kind of situations are really available for us, but they're also a great source for understanding the brain. And in the extraoperative situation, you all know that we have in the subdural electrodes on the surface of the brain, and we have those depth electrodes now called SEG, where we can, in our hands, we attach to it microwires in this Benke-Fried electrode that we have been using over the last two decades to try to decipher the neural code for memory in humans, and trying to see how we can translate this neural code perhaps into something that we can do for our patients. So this was the challenge. So if we look at what we can extract from the brain itself, you know, what we can, because remember, the first challenge is to decode, meaning what? You know, if we understand the neural code, can we translate, you know, this firing of neurons, which is really the language of the nervous system, can we translate it into function? And then we need to know that the transformation, how it can be done. So we can measure action potential, which is at 10K hertz essentially, and going down to local field potentials. This we can measure from the brain, and as neurosurgeons who have electrodes in the brain, this is really the only opportunity to really look at this in humans. So, and the only thing that we hear are really the firing of the neurons, really, that we can essentially look at with those microwires at the end of our electrodes, which we place in epilepsy patients, of course, for monitoring of seizures. But we can also come there and present them with all kinds of memory tasks and see what the neurons are doing. So, of course, deep brain stimulation, I just, want to mention it, you all know, is being used, of course, as another measure of stimulating the brain, but also now in the more advanced DBS situations, we can also extract information at the same time. This is not the topic of our talk, but there's great work being done by many people, including Phil Starr and other people, about closing the loop here in deep brain stimulation. This, we don't need to go over this, but this has been figured out more or less, in terms of the circuits. It's probably easy to really look at a function such as a motor function, but what about the cognitive function? You cannot just stimulate and the patient is not going to tell you, I feel smarter, or suddenly I remember. So the challenge is a bit more in terms of measuring what you can achieve. Now, a great advance in the last few years that is only available in North America at this stage is responsive neurostimulation, which is the first closed loop system approved by the FDA to use for epilepsy. And this is a system where we implant the neurostimulator in the skull itself, as you can see here. And then we can attach to it two electrodes at this point. Each one has four contacts. It can be either a depth electrode or a subdural electrode. And actually we can measure and then see seizure activity, and then you can apply stimulation to stop it. So this is a closed loop system. You can see here electrodes in the hippocampus itself. Right here, you can see the unit implanted in the skull, not in the chest, as in most DBS procedure. And what's happening here is that this information can be downloaded by the patient itself, by a wand, actually. It can be transmitted over the internet, essentially, to a center which can process the information. So you can already see that a lot of challenges are here when we are trying to transmit a lot of information in this kind of situation from patients, and we will need to deal in the future, already in the present, with issue of privacy and patients' rights, etc., which I won't get into at this point, but this may be a point for discussion. At UCLA, just between 2014, when it was approved, to 2018, we implanted 40 patients. Now we are over 100. And in these 38 patients for epilepsy, essentially having 22 with medial temporal lobe placement, 15 bilateral, because you can apply this in a case where you have more than one focus. You have median reduction of seizure frequency of 75%. And we have a select group, about 30% of the patients, who are super responders, what we call them super responders, because they have greater than 90% reduction in seizure. So this is a work by Don Eliashiv at UCLA in our group. But of course, this can be used also for other causes. Here is Nesya Sudana and Zara Adjan and others at UCLA have a whole lab now using RNS and virtual reality devices. Because remember, these are patients which are implanted with RNS devices chronically. And you can all the time carry a conversation with the brain, recording and stimulating. And we have a paper in Neuron. First also is Uros Topalovich, again with Nenthia and her group, about wireless programmable recording and stimulation of deep brain activity in freely moving humans. So now you can implant those things in patients with other issues such as PTSD, which is already done at UCLA, patient with morbid obesity, which is done at Stanford. So there are a lot of opportunities to really to look at neurological function and how we can help. And of course, cognition and memory, you know, is our main interest here. So when we are talking about this future in which we will start to edit memories, you know, we're talking about decoding, enhancing, incepting, and deletions. You know, this is really the brave new world that we are walking into, okay? So the science, you know, what is the science? First of all, the neural code. You know, it's exasperating, really. You're just looking at all those stations of the visual information. But at the top, you got the hippocampus and entorhinal cortex. You know, these are neurosurgical targets. We as neurosurgeons know these areas, right? We know the hippocampus, the amygdala, the entorhinal cortex. You know, we see them. And I look at it in this way. I look at the hippocampus, as many others, as a memory hub of the human brain, And the entorhinal area, which you may be familiar with, is really what I look at as the golden gate into the hippocampus, because marvelously, all this information goes through a very narrow area into the hippocampus, and that's the only information which you will eventually recall, you know, from my talk. If you want to remember it more consciously, your only hope is the hippocampus and the entorhinal area in your brains. So, you know, this is, you know, we see it in surgery today, obviously, when we go into the temporal horn, you know, we look at the hippocampus here, in surgery here, called plexus, head, body. But we also know from a study that the London taxi driver, because before the disaster of computer navigation and of Waze and of Google Maps, you know, the London drivers had actually to use their brains to navigate. And they found out that those guys, you know, they had actually bigger hippocampi than you and me, in fact. And I wouldn't be surprised if those have degenerated a bit, you know, over the last decade, you know, full of technical advancements, so to speak, right? So, you know, in 2014, you know, these two gentlemen and lady got the Nobel Prize for finding the place cells and the grid cells, you know, which are really navigational cells in the hippocampus of the rodents. And you know, we have basically over the last 15 years showed the existence, and we don't have too much time to talk about it, but the existing of place cells in humans in this Nature paper in 2003, just by having our patient navigate a virtual city on their computers. And 10 years later, you know, we have shown the existing of grid cells. You know, these are special cells in entorhinal cortex which map the environment. It's sort of a GPS for navigational memory. So already in 2012, we asked ourselves, how can enhance this function? And in this paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, by using electrodes which we placed anywhere in our patient, our epilepsy patient, we were able to show, and I'll gloss over this slide, next slide for the lack of time, but we were able to show basically that we were able in a virtual city to have our patients remember the layout better. They are playing, you know, taxi drivers, essentially, like the London taxi driver, and showing that it was easier, actually, for them to perform the task they remember better when we stimulated in entorhinal cortex. So that was one finding, which we published at the time. Stimulation in entorhinal area, the entry into the hippocampus, that what enabled really a better encoding of navigational memory. And later, we were dealing for several years with the encoding of faces and actually visual stimuli, like, you know, Marilyn Monroe. You see Marilyn Monroe, she becomes Marilyn Monroe of the mind, right? And then you remember her after a while. That happens with every person and every situation that you see. That's called episodic memory. So we, you know, looking at, you know, in many, many studies, and I don't have time to talk about it, but we found this what we call concept cells, which responds to particular concepts like Luke Skywalker. And it doesn't matter really in what way it's presented, even in a pictorial way or as a iconic way or even as a sound. These cells are very smart and they can basically encode this in the same way that you are encoding or recognizing Einstein now, although Einstein appears in various, you know, pictures here. You know in 200 milliseconds who we are dealing with, and you will remember that. And that's what we showed, that the neural code has really concept cells, and those are the cells which are, to a large extent, response for transformation of this huge multisensory barrage that you are exposed to every day and every minute of your conscious life. It is transformed into durable representation. But again, you know, we're neurosurgeons. We ask, how can we intervene? And again, we found out that stimulating in entorhinal cortex, really, we can actually, by stimulating there, we can make people remember faces better. Okay, this was some kind of micro-stimulation that we managed to engineer into the right entorhinal cortex, and then you were able to memorize faces and people in a specific way, meaning what we call memory specificity, okay? So, again, and now, again, one slide only to show you what we have been doing in the last 3 years, working on promoting consolidation of memory during sleep. Sleep is a wonderful opportunity. You have a captive audience, right? You can stimulate and actually help the consolidations of memories, you know, from the previous day into durable memories. And we have a closed loop system in this work, which was done by a postdoc, Maya Geva-Sagiv, in collaboration with Yuval Nir at Tel Aviv University. So that's where we are essentially now, okay? What we are probably able to do, and I gloss over that because there's no time, what we are able to really do is, what we are able to do is really enhance memory, meaning we are able to elevate our ability to encode memory or consolidate memory. But the real challenge and what is going to really happen in the future, that we will need to be able to deal with specific thoughts and specific memories. And that is where we are not at yet now. But in the animal domain, there is already optogenetic techniques where you can identify, for instance, a certain place cells in a rodent's brain, and then have the rodent remember that place better or go back the next day into that same place that you want them to go or to, quote, remember, okay? That's a paper in Science in 2013. And there is, you know, an array of papers which, you know, are talking essentially, I try to use this, you know, movie in Inception to kind of put you in the right mood. But, you know, if from a theoretical standpoint, we can find the machinery in the brain which encode, you know, this particular actress, or which encodes, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, and we can, during sleep, we can, in principle, really promote the memory for this particular concept or this particular mental construct. Now, of course, we're not doing it at this point, but already in the animal literature is already a way, because what happens during your sleep in the rodent's brain, the places that the rodents visited can be seen as sequences of firing of cells. And if you identify it online, you can actually enhance those. And the rodent in these studies wakes up the next day and he goes to that particular place if you reinforce it, or avoid that particular place if you attach it to a negative stimuli. So this has to do with the ability to identify neuronal sequences which are specific to specific memories or specific thoughts. And this is done by optogenetic techniques, which obviously at this stage are only starting to get into the human domain in very special instances, like blindness, and it has just been a recent paper about it. But I'm just posing this sort of as a challenge. So coming back to what are the challenges? You know, here is a diagram by Dan Markovich at UCLA in electrical engineering, you know, looking at such a system, which I would call this a memory aid. And I would pose to you the basic question, if you accept a hearing aid, why wouldn't you accept a memory aid? If I could give you a memory aid or cochlear implant-like device which will enhance memory, what would you say about it? I mean, is this where the future is really leading us? So the limitation, as I've said, were partly an engineering limitation. You know, this is a neuropixel probe which is now used in rodents and in non-human primates, which can record from 1,000 neurons at the same time. And many of you, or some of you, have heard about Neuralink, you know, the relatively new enterprise of Elon Musk, where a robot is looking at the surface of the brain and, like a sewing machine, places thread-like electrodes into the brain, avoiding vessels, and putting hundreds of those in, and all this through a small bear hole, okay, which you can plug, you know, with this device, which is held, you know, by the finger, and essentially can communicate wirelessly. And it is not a dream, you know, it's already, some of you have seen this Three Little Pig show that he had about 6 months ago. This is a robot, by the way. And recently having a monkey playing Pong. And right now, this kind of technology is geared toward patient, you know, who are quadriplegic, and by thought will be able to move perhaps a robotic arm. But if you have 1,000 channels, you will be doing much better than what you are doing now with UTA arrays, you know, which have only 100 channels. So by one order of magnitude or more, technology can bring us forward. But of course, we need the science, and mostly we need the neurosurgeons, right, to meet these four challenges, you know, which I sort of placed at the beginning of this talk: the science, the engineering, the medicine, and the societal challenge. And I think the most important thing, you know, for us really as neurosurgeons, to realize that we are important players at this table of the future. And I will leave you with this statement, which I guess leaves us for a few minutes for questions and discussion. So thank you very much for your attention.
So if I might say, thank you, Itzhak, fantastic lecture. But I mean, we are friends from many, many years, so you didn't expect me to say thank you, Itzhak, for a bad lecture. But yes, thank you, Itzhak, for a fantastic lecture indeed. the point is, I think what when you address, or when people addresses the problem of Alzheimer's with memory, I think that also addresses, and we spoke about that, addresses the issue of consciousness, because it's not only memory per se. I mean, am I able to recite the entire poem that I learned when I was in fifth grade? Yeah, okay. But is that the whole thing that comes together with the poem? I mean, when I look at Tony DeSales, I known him since the 1993. Okay, I recognize his face. Yeah, that's Tony. But with that thing comes a whole world of things that make who I am. So I think the fantastic challenge that your work and other people like you, and as Tony talked about that yesterday with Alessandra, is a challenge that we will finally, neurosurgeons will unravel the problem of consciousness. No, I mean, this is the holy grail that we are addressing finally. It's not only that you remember the face of your grandchildren, it's that you understand who your grandchildren were, no? Are for you.
Yeah, I, you know, absolutely agree with it. Of course, consciousness is what you call the big C, or the heart problem you know, this is the hardest problem. But I think from a practical standpoint, you know, when you look at Alzheimer patient at the very early stage, maybe even at the minimal cognitive impairment stage, you know, their problem is not to remember, you know, Tony DeSales 20 years ago. Their problem is remember what they ate for breakfast. Their problem is really to deal with the challenges of making new memories. Okay, and that is really what enables them to function in society. So from a practical standpoint, it's a real issue how to help them really at that early stage. Yeah, it's the same way that we are helping Parkinson patients at a relatively early stage. I mean, we can help them at the very latest stage because the system is already ruined, okay? But I think our goal is to give them some quality of life at a relatively early stage. We're not going to make them conscious or unconscious. This is obviously a very difficult problem and a separate one.
I think what Yitzhak did today was again show a view of the 21st century. And we started the meeting with Tony's talk and Alessandra's talk, which was again about how neurosurgery will change before 2100. This whole concept of the meeting is pioneering in terms of education. The world is getting smaller, and we think everybody around the world has ideas, and we want to get everybody together to share the ideas. In many ways, technology is not up to that challenge, because technology has trouble with that. People have trouble with technology. But that's the world we're emerging into. We're moving from the 20th century into the 21st century. And if you look around the world, every country in the world is having trouble with that transition. They're having trouble politically, economically, socially, intellectually, and we are no different. This meeting in itself was an experiment. It was an experiment in education. Can we get people together and discuss ideas openly? Do we need slides? It was proved this morning when the technology failed. We went on anyway, and we had a discussion with people. It was proved yesterday. We've seen the fact that you can present ideas and get multiple different inputs and find that even the experts can disagree. We've had everybody pay attention to the low and middle income countries. As Samer Ho showed in the neurointensive care session, the problems they face in Baghdad are far different than what we face in Los Angeles or New York. And how do you solve those problems? You do the best you can with what you've got everywhere in the world. And there is no one right answer for everybody. Which then gets back to some of the politics of today of trying to have everybody ruled by one philosophy. It won't work. It'll fail. So anyway, I want to thank all the people who came. As of yesterday, we had over 1,000 people who came from over 150 countries. They didn't all stay today. We've had a majority of the people came from low to middle income countries, and we're very excited. From the poll yesterday, 85% of the people in each session said that it was either good to excellent. And when asked if they want to have more of these, 95% said yes. So that tells us where we are coming from, what happened. We're meeting a world of the 21st century. Neurosurgery has to move into the 21st century. In Africa, it's moving from the 20th century into the 21st century. It's painful. They need help. We need to help them. We see our colleagues in China with enormous advances. We had a talk yesterday about how you can repair the spinal cord, something we were been taught for decades you cannot do. You cannot do that. And we saw a dog walking yesterday after the spinal cord was cut. And what can you possibly say about that? Except that it worked. we need to have more understanding of the science. We've just heard Itzhak say, and I have a hearing aid, I have glasses, why not have something for memory? We have people, and I don't think he had a chance to talk about it, but they're working on it, where you can take people who are blind and get them to see at least something. These are amazing advances. We've seen aneurysms, which were prominent, and Tony mentioned this yesterday, in the 20th century, are being replaced by interventional surgery. Juha mentioned that this morning. But there are some places where it's too costly, so you have to still know how to do traditional things. So neurosurgeons need to be prepared for the 21st century. And that's what we're trying to do. That's what this is. That's what this was, an experiment. I particularly want to thank Ather, Jorge, Jim West, who's a young resident, who is phenomenal help, Mike Chile, who is our IT person, who you can imagine what it is with working with a few neurosurgeons, what it is working with 100. So I think that everybody tried extremely hard. We've worked on this for 16 months. To bring this new venture, this new experiment to you. We hope that it was valuable. We hope you learned something. I did. I want to thank Itzhak, Xiaoping Ren, Tony, for just introducing very revolutionary concepts. Langston Holly for doing a wonderful spine session along with intracranialists. And Paul for taking on what was a very controversial issue of intracranial hematoma and traumatic brain injury and seeing how this is solved around the world. There is no one right answer. They can't afford intracranial pressure monitors in Baghdad. It doesn't matter. We have to go on. So we appreciate it. Jorge has been a great friend for a long time. I appreciate his wise counsel. And I appreciate everybody who's contributed, the 57 speakers who spent a lot of time. We can all do better. We wish you the best. We want to evaluate what all the polling is. We're probably going to ask you some more questions independently so we can decide what to do in the future. Do we have more of these meetings? How frequently do we have them? If we have them, what should be their content? We've experimented with things. And we've got to have to experiment with more things, because education is going to be different than it was in the 20th century. It isn't lectures. It's communicating information and experience. That's the 21st century. And the technology we have to harness to do what we want, not the other way around. So thank you all very much. We hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to all my friends who helped. We really appreciate it. Have a good day. Have a good weekend.